Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Happy Regional Week.
Happy Regional Week. Happy We Shouldn't Be Here, But Who Cares Week.
Not Gravy, though. It's not Gravy Week.
No, we have Gravy Weeks in November. That's what you get for winning the Battle for Atlantis.
That's what we get for beating Boston College. This is a week for beating the soon-to-be-overrated but currently properly rated Gonzaga Bulldogs.
Yeah, you know, the Zags are interesting.
I'm terrified of the Zags.
Oh, so am I. What I found, though, is like I've never been one to be overly complimentary of them. But I will admit the last 2 years, I feel like they've actually earned it. I definitely felt that the year they got that one seed was completely just like undeserved, and I felt like in general, like, you know, the college basketball media is similar to, I'd say it's less similar to college football media than it is to NFL media, in that it just like it loves to grasp on to tired, hackneyed narratives, and like for some reason all the administrators and all the media and most of the fans and everyone who's on the tournament committee seemed to buy a narrative about Gonzaga for a long time that wasn't necessarily true. And I think the last 2 years, however, that narrative's actually come to fruition, and now we're kind of seeing, you know, I think people are seeing with Syracuse and Gonzaga, this is the result of what happens when, you know, you see teams maybe a little bit lower than they should have been seeded, and again, like, there's also nothing to apologize for. Like, Gonzaga's done plenty to get where they are, and so have we. We've done the same thing as several two seeds, and then many more two seeds to come. And I think that, you know, this provides an interesting, it provides an interesting study of narrative, and I hate that it's even, you know, a kind of part of the conversation this week, but I think whoever wins, it's going to be a very, very interesting case to see how they're viewed versus the expectations of how they should be viewed.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually don't even find an issue with the two seedings. I think before the tournament field was actually put out, you know, both of us were pretty open about, you know, if Syracuse doesn't make it, we understand. Now, that kind of went out the window and we saw some of the other teams that did make it, like Michigan and Tulsa, which I thought, and Vanderbilt, which I thought were all lesser teams. And then Gonzaga, obviously they won the WCC. They probably wouldn't have been in otherwise. But I just find it really frustrating. I totally get, as someone who writes on the internet, I totally get driving home as much as you can for a day or two about snubs and overseeding and underseeding and whatnot. But man, we're in the Sweet 16 now. Can we just like get over who got in the tournament? Because both these teams have done what they needed to do. And obviously Sean finessed this incredibly well with his open letter, better than any of us could. But, like, I think after the first weekend, or even after the first game, that why are we still talking about who got in the tournament? Like, that if Syracuse really didn't belong to be here, or belong in the tournament, or Gonzaga for that reason, for that, you know, they lost to St. Mary's a bunch, everyone was saying, oh, the Bulldogs are, this is their worst team in a long time. You know, who cares at this point? They both won two games. Let's get on with the actual matchups at hand. And it just seems like, I think a lot of it's because Syracuse is, you know, quote unquote, unlikable to a lot of outside people, and whatever else. Like, I just think people can't let go of it. And it's weird because I've seen comparisons to last year's UCLA team, and I totally get them. I just don't remember people getting this worked up about UCLA a weekend into the tournament. Like, I think people by the Sweet 16 were like, okay, well, UCLA is hot and they're very talented and they've won the games they need to win, and that just does not seem to be the prevailing notion with Syracuse on a national level.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's good you bring up UCLA because I was actually going to go there myself, residing in the general area of UCLA and its fan base and the radio markets that might talk about it and the media that might talk about it in general. Local fans elated that they got there, radio elated they got there. The conversation, I remember the national conversation too, everything just shifted away from like, okay, you know, you beat what, and they did the same thing we did, right? They beat a 7 and a 15. Like that narrative vanished and its place was, Let's see how dangerous UCLA is. Let's see if they can beat Gonzaga. To me, I think this is a product of a lot of the NCAA stuff. I think the NCAA stuff gave people who were long waiting to pile on to Syracuse, some easy talking points and excuses, and those continue today. I think that some of it's bitterness on the part of media, whether it's they wanted to go to Syracuse or they can't stand being surrounded by people that went to Syracuse. I think that Boeheim's become an institution, even outside of how we consider him. And I think people at some point or another, you just hate institutions, and you know that goes for any dynasty, that goes for any long successful franchise, like goes any long successful college team. And I think, it's in some ways, and Sean said it in today's post, like it's kind of a compliment, like where at this point we've reached a level where even casual folks can weigh in and dislike us. And you know what? I think the only way to deal with it is to embrace it. I hope that we can continue to do so, because it's getting funnier and funnier to see America get so just damn angry about our inclusion in this thing. When again, we're far from the worst. I mean, RPI number might have said one thing, but we're far from the worst at large team to ever be in this field, and we're far from the worst at large team to ever go a couple of rounds through.
Yeah, it's really funny. And I actually looked up UCLA. They were the team that beat SMU. They were an 11, SMU was a 6. And they had that weird, was it a goaltending that shouldn't have been a goaltending or something on SMU at the last play?
Oh, yeah.
And then they beat UAB, who had just upset Iowa State, if I'm not mistaken, because Iowa State always, except for this year, of course. So it's actually kind of similar. They blew out UAB. They snuck by SMU by a point. So whereas Syracuse actually has, one of the best margins of victory in the tournament so far, because they're playing incredibly well. But yeah, it actually reminds me of a thing I wrote for the site, the whole disrespect thing. And I hate using disrespect because we make fun of Clemson for it so much. but this whole thing, going back to 2012, which, if you remember, the tournament came basically a week after Pat Forty wrote his, like, no actual news, but we're going to throw this out there piece on Syracuse players might have smoked weed once thing, which ended up being a part of the notice of allegations and whatnot, but there really wasn't any substance to his piece. So that turned Syracuse into like a villainous program, except they were a one seed that year. And I forget, there was this Hodel hit piece written about how everyone should root against Syracuse. And I wrote this big thing about, if Syracuse has demons, like every other team that's still in the tournament has players who have been arrested, who have coaches who have done certain things. So it's not that Syracuse is some like angelic program. I think we all admit, even though the NCAA stuff has been blown out of proportions, there were things committed. Like, Syracuse wasn't totally innocent. But, man, like, there is no totally innocent program. I don't care who you are. You can bring up stories for any program. John Wooden was considered, like, a rampant cheater now, if you just looked into it a little bit. There was the Troy McGinnis stuff with Coach K. Like, even if stuff doesn't actually end up being followed through to NCAA bans and postseason stuff, like, there's no clean program that's successful. I'm sorry. And it's still lingering around because of last year's ban, and because Boeheim is pretty cold to people on the outside, and they don't understand him or get him. So it's tired. I appreciate kind of the leaning into it at this point, because I think we have in the past been a little sensitive about it, and now we're just like, okay, well, if this is what we are, this is what we are, and we'll just play this up, and hopefully we can ride the wave as long as we can.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like, I didn't grow up a Yankees fan. I didn't grow up a fan of the Lakers or any team like that. So I was much more used to being a fan of a team that when they were successful, you enjoyed it and you were surprised by it and all that. So being a Syracuse fan is only natural there. So it's a new feeling for me, and I would bet there's a lot of that. I mean, I don't have the exact numbers. I'm sure there's plenty of Yankees fans that also root for Syracuse, but I would bet that there's a lot of fans of Syracuse who, if they do root for pro sports at all, they might not be the most successful teams in the world. It's weird if you haven't embraced it. And, like, for me, I haven't, if only because, like, it took me a long time to embrace it with Syracuse, and that long time would lead up until about now. Just because, all my other sports rooting interest, it never was something I was I was part of and never really understood the draw of it. But now I actually do. I get it. You know, there's a driving force. There's a motivation. Granted, Syracuse gave people reason to doubt them, and I think that's one thing that, you know, if Duke gives reason to doubt, it's like you give reason to doubt Duke as a number one seed or as a national title contender that year. It doesn't mean you doubt their program as a whole. Same with Kansas, same with Kentucky, same with North Carolina, and I think that that's maybe where the distinction lies between those programs and ours, and those programs' ability to embrace some hatred and dislike, especially on like the Duke and UNC and Kentucky fronts, and just embrace that and embrace the fact that you know, with success comes scrutiny and people overly dissecting minutia and all this other nonsense. And I guess, you know, for fans, at the end of the day, yes, Syracuse is a huge fan base and a very popular team and all that, but Syracuse is still, you know, a fairly small private school in a small city, and that's never going to change no matter how many championships we do or don't win. And so for its fans and its alums and students and everything else, it does become, I think it's tougher than most of those other schools to understand how the microscope gets, you know, just so centered on every little thing that happens to us, when all the other big programs, that's been the case for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm kind of the same way. I'm a, you know, a Mets fan, and I root for the Green Bay Packers, who are very successful, but don't really have like the villain tag for one reason or another. So yeah, a little different, but whatever. I'm over it. I'm tired of, like, you just at some point you realize no matter what you say or what's true or whatever, your tweets at Doug Gottlieb are never going to have Doug Gottlieb admitting that he's, you know, blowing up something that's not there. Like, it's just not going to happen. People have established what they feel, and it might be right or wrong, but there's just so little way to actually change the narrative. So maybe just ignoring it and going to actually win the basketball games, which are played in this tournament, is the best way to go about things. And I think SU's done a nice job of that. They've won both games by a lot of points.
I would agree. And I also think, you know, this is the right team to kind of embrace that too. I mean, players rarely talk a ton about, you know, how much media they read and how much they listen to their critics and things like that. But, you know, a quick survey of these players' Twitter feed showed this isn't really a team that's sitting around, you know, retweeting everything and trying to get a read on how people consider them and all that. And so I think that the buzz that does rise up, I think Boeheim is a lot smarter than people give him credit for outside of the program and outside of the fan base. And that is, like, he knows how to motivate players. Yes, sometimes there's moments where you might say, yeah, maybe you shouldn't have run over Tyler Roberson with a truck. But at the same time, that same Tyler Roberson was a big reason why we beat Dayton, and he put in another solid performance against Middle Tennessee State. I have a feeling that if Boeheim does share anything in the media, I think he's very calculated with it, and I think he's very smart about, you know, what he knows is going to motivate this team. Because this team, again, they're smart, they're mature. I mean, even the younger players, I feel like they can function more mature beyond their years and have already showed a certain amount of, I guess, gravitas in this tournament through two games than especially the freshmen would normally be able to, given the circumstances.
Right, and of course, Boeheim a couple weeks ago got absolutely killed by people for his comments about Roberson, and I do agree they were a little harsh, but it's one of those things where you have to understand, like, A, Roberson knows who he plays for, so I don't think he was as negatively impacted from it as, like, everyone else tried to make it out. And then, of course, after the amazing game he had against Dayton, Boeheim, if you watch that locker room video, had some awesome things to say about him, and I think they gave him the game ball, and the whole team, like, group hugged him, and naturally, that was not part of any kind of narrative. No one recognized that, because why would they?
Yeah, exactly. Why would they? I mean, and we're not going to dive down this rabbit hole, because, I mean, it's something important, but it's not something that we typically cover on the podcast, and that is, like, media narratives exist for a reason, and the media never wants to admit it's wrong. So, and again, we're members of the media in many ways. Media never wants to admit it's wrong, so whether it's something, you know, stupid and inconsequential, like, you know, whether or not Syracuse deserves respect or whether it's something more serious, like the many, many issues affecting this country and the world. You know, the media establishes narrative. It's going to ride it out until something very, very blatant happens to prove it wrong. I mean, you saw it, again, redirecting back to sports. You saw the shift back in 2013 when Syracuse made the Final Four. And, you know, there was a strict narrative about Boeheim underperforming since 2003 and about, you know, not getting past the Sweet 16 and not doing this and not doing that and not getting back to the Final Four. And then that team and that defense put on a tour de force for four, you know, straight games to get out of the region. And then suddenly the narrative shifted on a dime to Jim Boeheim still got it. You know, this program is as good as it's ever been. It's a well-oiled machine. So, I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, don't be positive. Don't try to find positivity until we see this big sea change, because it might not happen. But just to point out, like, the media is very, very slow to move, and you might have to wait a while. But the payoff is there, and to be honest, I don't really think there is, for me anyway, a payoff of just hearing the things that, you know, Dan, you and I and so many other people listening and so many other people reading the blog already knew.
Right. I think it happens when Hopkins takes over, because Hopkins is definitely more pleasant than Boeheim. And then, of course, if Hopkins doesn't have wild success, it will immediately change on him. So look out for that in like 2018 or whenever. That'll be fun.
Well, I mean, to be honest, like, I was surprised that there wasn't more of a national fervor around how Syracuse played under Hopkins. And again, I think we largely defended him here. I had not doubts about him. I just had concerns about how things went. But you know what? Given the circumstances, it is what it is. Obviously, we made the tournament. Obviously, we made the Sweet 16. You know, we'll talk about gravy when it's over. But if, God forbid, this is the end, I'd say that Hopkins being there for 9 games and going 4-5 did absolutely nothing to change the trajectory in a negative way of the Syracuse team. I don't think any of those losses, maybe the St. John's one, but even then probably not. I don't think any of those losses really prevented Syracuse from reaching its full potential. And I think the only thing that can, more often than not, stop Syracuse in this zone, especially when it's humming the way it is, from reaching its full potential is itself.
Right. Oh, and speaking of the Hopkins thing, one narrative that we actually didn't touch on because it was like right in the fervor of Selection Sunday, I think, is there was a, I forget what writer from the Washington Post, who literally, I'm pretty sure just made up a quote from Boeheim, and Boeheim's quote was something along the lines of Hopkins was basically put in an unwinnable situation, and one, he literally says, one day he's going to be a better coach than me, but this wasn't the time. And the Washington Post writer wrote that Boeheim basically said that Hopkins was a bad coach, which just was so far from what was, like, it wasn't even out of context. It was just not what he said. So, yeah, it's been a fun couple weeks here in Syracuse land, and hopefully we can make it to the Final Four so we get even more revisionist history and edited quotes and everything else. That'll be, I'm riding the wave right now, and I usually hate, like, the overly sensitive stuff like this that we see from like the New England Patriots and other fan bases, but I'm all with it right now. We're going for it.
Yeah, we're going for it. You know what? We're meeting it aggressively, and the best way to do that is winning basketball games. And again, hopefully, we can do more of that. You know, I kind of started in at the beginning of the show talking about how I sometimes didn't always give Gonzaga proper credit, and I think that I can revise that now after the last 2 years. But Dan, have you noticed that Gonzaga fans seem awfully confident? I mean, is some of that based on the national media being awfully confident in the Zags, or is it that the Bulldogs fans are just very, very, very kind of comfortable in who they are and what they do, and they're, it seems like they've fallen right back into it, and some, maybe in a good way, this Cinderella role that they once inhabited back in the day. And they actually feel better about that than maybe being, you know, a favorite team week in and week out.
I don't know. I don't know any Zags fans, to be honest. I don't think they have like a really wide-ranging fan base, but obviously they're pretty passionate, and they should be. They've had a really awesome team, like small conference team, for a while here. But I think probably most of it, if I had to guess, stems out of them beating the hell out of Utah, a number three seed, and they beat Seton Hall pretty comfortably, although that game would have been closer if Seton Hall wasn't based. Seton Hall shot like 30% from the free throw line, which was one of the – and I'm a Syracuse fan, if anyone doesn't know that, listening to a Syracuse podcast. Seton Hall had a worse free throw performance than I've ever seen Syracuse have. So they won both games very comfortably. They blew it a three seed. So I can't really knock them for being positive. It is a little weird because, like we said, Gonzaga, like admittedly, this isn't a knock, was not going to be in the tournament if they didn't win their tournament, their conference tournament. But I mean, you can throw that all out now. They're playing really good basketball. They have two, I think, bona fide star players. Their weaknesses, their guard play, really hasn't been an issue for them the last couple of games. And again, when you have Wilcher and Sabonis, it masks a lot of issues. Your guards can just be kind of reliable. And I know they have the one guy on their team who was their conference defensive player of the year, so he at least provides on that end of the floor. Overall, I mean, I guess they've been winning pretty consistently. Obviously, they've had their tournament flameouts, like you said, in the last couple of years, and then obviously they made the Elite Eight last year. But I think they've kind of looked at us like we've looked at some other teams. Like, why wouldn't we be able to beat this group? They're not, you know, they don't have dominant players. Obviously, I think Mike Benajay is pretty close to one. I don't know why he doesn't really get that rep, but that's fine. And they have two really hot, you know, star players that have done a lot of press, and they're rolling. So I think it's hard to not believe in your team when they've been playing the way Gonzaga is.
Yeah, and at the same point, I think it's hard not to believe in your team when they're playing like Syracuse is too. I see Syracuse winning, but I don't think it's going to be a pretty game. I don't think it's going to look anything like the last couple games. I think we're going to get really beaten up inside, and we're going to have to find a way to balance that out with some better shooting. But, you know, to me, like, I think the one thing the Zags get on their side in games against teams like Utah and maybe to a point Seton Hall and some others, and obviously, like, many of the Zags' past victims when they were a, you know, lower seed, is that those teams did a lot of looking past the Zags, no matter how many times they made tournament, they made the Sweet 16, whatever it is. Teams that have a tendency to look past the Zags because either they were one star player and a lot of solid contributors, or they were two star players and three guys that just knew, you know, which buttons to press at the right time. And you know, that's not a bad way to design a team. Gonzaga's put together a very solid program, you know, over the past, you know, nearly two decades now, and it's admirable, especially given, you know, again, there's some similarities there too. There's a certain amount of geography. There's a certain, you know, remote aspect to Spokane, similar to Syracuse. I mean, obviously the talent Syracuse has access to in the Northeast, and especially in New York State, far outweighs what you can find in the Pacific Northwest. But at the same time, like, you can definitely see some similarities, and you can definitely see, like, Syracuse isn't built like, I mean, we've been caught looking ahead, but a 10-seed Syracuse is not going to get caught looking ahead of anybody, which I guess is something that you might not be able to quantify, but it's something that definitely factors in that might not have against the Zags' previous opponents, and might not if the Zags win against their next one either.
Right, I'm really interested in this matchup. You kind of alluded to how you think Syracuse will win close. I said earlier, you know, they're terrifying for me personally, and it's not really the overall talent. It's those two guys, Wilcher and Sabonis, who both seem like kind of the prototype guys to beat the zone. But I actually saw an interesting comparison, not in an ability, because this team I'm going to bring up is way more talented and accomplished. But someone said, you know, the Indiana 2013 team also had exactly who you need to beat the zone. You had Zeller, who could score from all over and was a big guy who could put it door to the high post. You had all other, you know, a ton of other scorers, a lot of really good shooters, and they just, like, literally, legitimately couldn't figure it out. So I think this really comes down to, does Mark Few have kind of the secret sauce to beat the zone. In 2010, his team was pretty outclassed by Syracuse's team, even without Orenze Onuwaku, but their two big guys had pretty nice games, but their guards didn't do anything, and they never really looked like a team that was going to give SU any real danger. So it's interesting because I think this team profiles similarly. That team had Sacre and Aaron Harris, and this team has Wiltshire and Sabonis, both, you know, forwards all around. Guard play is a big weakness. And if they can't actually attack the zone effectively, like, just having those players isn't enough to just beat it. So I think that's really where this matchup lies. I think it's effectiveness versus just, like, the raw talent and stills.
Yeah, I totally buy that. And I think, you know, I tried to get that point across. I answered a Q&A over at SB Nation's Gonzaga blog, The Slipper Still Fits, and I would recommend that if anyone hasn't read it. The blog's really good, too, obviously. They have plenty of great analysis on this week's game. But the one thing I kind of pointed out to them, too, was, like, you know what? Like, Syracuse is not – I'm going to say it right out. Like, Syracuse is not going to shut down both of these players. It's just not going to happen. I mean, they might be able to do one, but – yeah, Sabonis and Wiltshire are going to be able to find their points. It's just whether or not Syracuse can do enough on its own end to you know, put the basket in, well, put the ball in the basket, excuse me. And also on top of that, I think, you know, the rebounding edge is such a big factor. I know we were close to Middle Tennessee State, but I believe we still lost that by maybe one or two. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But I know that we absolutely dominated Dayton on the boards. And I think, unfortunately, we're going to need a performance maybe closer to Dayton, or, realistically, even breaking even, given our lack of size, breaking even with a team like Gonzaga on rebounds might actually, especially if we have a lot more offensive boards, might actually be the same as out-rebounding Dayton by 20, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I'm actually looking. We actually out-rebounded Middle Tennessee by two. So, anytime Syracuse is close, it's kind of a win, and it all really depends on mostly Roberson, and then a little bit of like how long did we play Daewon and how good was he? Because he has some, you know, nights where he's really active and picks up a bunch in like a short period of time. But mostly, like, if Roberson's good, as he's been the first two games, Syracuse is pretty competitive on the rebound on the boards. If he's not, like, Syracuse just gets crushed. So, I mean, it's this no surprise to anyone who's watched the team. Like, Roberson is a huge X factor.
Oh, absolutely. And the other one, and it was something that their fans were bringing up, and they were saying in our Q&A over on Noon Magician, they were saying, you know, if we shut down Benajay, and it's funny, I responded, and other people did too, but the big thing was, like, if they shut down Benajay, it still means he scored 10 points, and it still means that because Benajay is a smart player and because he understands how important he is to this team, he probably ends up figuring out ways to be productive elsewhere. I mean, we've seen it before. Benajay has had some bad shooting games this year. He's also had some games where he just hasn't shot much because he's found ways to be more active on defense. He's found ways to pass the ball. He's found ways to you know, help on the boards. He's found ways to be a distraction so that he could get other players open. Like, Benajay is a very smart basketball player, and there's a reason why, you know, Syracuse is going to miss him a lot next year. It's because he just understands the game. Maybe that's, you know, in part because he's played under two of the best coaches around. Maybe it's in part because he's a fifth-year senior, but, you know, Benajay gets it. He understands that while he's a star player, he doesn't always have to carry the team on his shoulders when he tries to or when the team needs him to. It's usually when we lose. But when he's able to be active and involved, and if he scores 14 points, but he also, you know, dished out five assists and managed four boards and got a couple steals and maybe a timely offensive foul that he forced and, you know, a couple nice defensive stops, like, I'd take that in a win any day over Benajay needing needing to score, you know, 24 and change.
Yeah, he's really, really good at understanding kind of the context of what's happening in a game with his team. Like you said, he doesn't force things. He'll take a command if he needs to. And there have been games where he's dropped like 30 points in the last couple of years where Benajay is like, all right, well, if this is going to happen, it's going to happen. We'll go for it. But like we've had games where Malachi has been unbelievable, like in that second half of the Dayton game where he took over. Bennett let him kind of lead things in the scoring end. There have been obviously the Cooney games, the mythical Cooney games where he goes nuts. And Minaje, just like he's always good at, even if he doesn't have the ball in his hands, like if Howard's in or someone else is running point, he kind of runs point from like a game flow point of view by just making sure the right players are getting their touches. If Lydon has a mismatch, and he's effectively scoring, like he'll have the ball more and Minaje will play more of a secondary role. But at the same time, he doesn't he's not overly passive. Like his passiveness is effective, rather than, you know, not wanting the ball in a big spot. And he at the same time has no problem taking, you know, a 25 footer in some dude's face and drilling it. We've seen that how many times this year. So he's definitely, we've had some players in the past that have kind of shied away from the big spot at times. And he seems to really have the balance quite perfectly for a star player.
Yeah, it's kind of wild, too, because I feel like, you know, a lot of, I think even in Syracuse history, like, everyone's kind of used to the guys that, like, either shy away from the spotlight but play well, or embrace the spotlight and, you know, you get what you get. I mean, you look at, you know, the double-edged sword of guys like, you know, and guys that we all enjoyed watching at the end of the day, but guys like Eric Diebendorf and Johnny Flynn and Andy Routens in the early part of his career, when he wasn't as reliable of a three-point threat. I mean, in general, like, Benajé does kind of strike a balance between a lot of these you know, famed Syracuse players where he understands his role. He will always have an impact on the game, and he doesn't care if it means he gets the headline or it means that he's a footnote in the box score, as long as he has a positive impact. And that's a player that, you know, it's a player that's irreplaceable. It's also a player that is very hard to account for, because you really don't know which one you're seeing. And to be honest, the one you're seeing, if you're the opposing team, ends up being dictated by what you do. And that can be frustrating because, again, he's going to find a way to beat you, even if it's not in the way you're initially scouting him to do so.
Right. And the one thing I do think, we've seen him get a little more press this week, which has been nice, is he really deserves it. He's one of the best players left in the tournament. There was I forget who wrote an article yesterday. They had basically had like the 16 best players left in the Sweet 16. I was like dreading that Benajé was going to be left off, but they actually left off Daniel House, which was weird. That was like the snub. Benajé was like 8 or something, which was pretty awesome to see. So he's starting to come along a little bit. If he has a big game, if they make the Elite Eight, I really think we'll, and he has a big game again, I think we'll really start to see that storyline picked up, because he's a great story. And it's really hard to deny he's personable. He's, you know, you can't ask for much more out of a player. And also, you know, he'll have a little redemption chance against maybe UVA, which would be cool, since, you know, home state team that he hasn't been able to beat yet. So, but of course, that's getting ahead of ourselves, because Gonzaga is very good and deserves our respect.
Oh, yeah. And don't worry, we're going to talk about a little bit more about that respect and a little bit more about who we might want to face and get ahead of ourselves. But first and foremost, a little halftime. Dan, what have you been drinking?
Nothing too crazy. A little more non-beer things this week. But I did have some Goose Island, always good. I had a little more of that Sneak Attack by 21st Amendment, just as it was around. Then last week I talked about it. It's not my favorite thing from them, and not my favorite Saison, but pretty decent. And I had the Nooner Pilsner from Sierra Nevada. I'm not a huge Pilsner fan generally. This was, you know, pretty nice and refreshing. Not my favorite type of beer, but Sierra Nevada does everything pretty well. And I was just looking at a tap, opening it up before we hopped on here. Did you see the bracket thing they're doing?
I did. I was not surprised by some of the macro breweries getting a little bit further than the seating. I think a lot of that just because of, you know, the tournament, especially the opening weeks, kind of breed some more binge drinking. But yeah, I mean, so far I think it was an interesting exercise. I'm surprised they didn't do it in the past, but I'm glad they're doing it now.
Yeah, and it's based on check-ins, so like,
right. So it's, I mean, I don't really know, easy to game.
I usually don't bother checking in if I'm drinking like a Bud Light, which is, you know, hopefully not that often, but like, because why bother? But no, it is cool to see, and I think the you know, the beers that they have left here make sense. You know, Founders, Ballast Point, obviously, Victory, Sierra Nevada. They actually put more than 64. It looks like, what, they had 128 on here?
I didn't notice that.
Or that's what it looks like. Is there... No, never mind, 64. Just like it's really bid bracket. Pretty interesting, though.
Yeah. And on my end, I know since we had the podcast early last week, had plenty of drinking to do after that. Was at both Rangers games out here, so it was a little drinking at the stadiums and nearby. So I had a Noble Aleworks, That's Unpossible IPA. Really, really good. Arguably the best IPA I've had all year as far as like new stuff goes. Some other things. Had a Atomic Kangaroo from the brewery. It's a very subtle kind of wild ale. They collaborated on it with Smog City. This one's about 3 years old. Had it when it originally came out. Still really holds up nice. Definitely recommended if it goes on sale again. Got to try out Luponic Distortion. It's an IPA from Firestone Walker. They kind of have this new experimental series that they've been kind of tossing around. And this was the first entry in that this year. I really enjoyed that one. Also got to check out Modern Times Devil's Teeth. It's an old ale with coffee. Had Ballast Point's Watermelon Dorado, their double IPA, and this tasted like a straight Jolly Rancher. I've been a big proponent of pineapple sculpin and grapefruit sculpin, but I'm not as big of a fan of watermelon just because I just felt it was too sweet.
The artificial watermelons is a very strange flavor.
Yeah, and like this one, I know it was like fresh watermelon added to the brewing process, but like at the same time, it just it tasted too much like Jolly Ranchers. I just think they probably needed to add too much to make it show up.
Yeah.
And a double IPA is a really hard style to do that with.
Yeah, Thomas Hooker up in Connecticut in the Hartford area, one of their like biggest beers is their watermelon ale, I think, and it's the same with that thing. It tastes like a straight up like alcoholic Jolly Rancher, which it's like interesting for a minute, but like you can't drink more than half of it without being like, all right, that's enough.
No, and yeah, I wasn't a huge fan, and I love everything Ballast Point puts together. I know as far as good watermelon beers, and I wouldn't say like great, just one that's passable is 21st Amendment and their Heller High Watermelon.
Yeah, that's actually pretty good. I enjoy that.
And that's because I think it's just a good pairing of flavor and style. You know, you don't have to add a ton of watermelon to get that to come through in a wheat beer. So that's how you end up with, I think, a better marriage there versus something, you know, involving an IPA. You're just going to need to put an overpowering amount of flavor to really get some results.
Yeah, it's a tough flavor, I think, to pull off. But I just think the key is, like, you know, I'd rather have too little of it than too much.
Agreed. Some other things. I went down to San Diego this weekend, stopped over at Modern Times. Never a dull moment there. They had this Infinity Beach Sour IPA, which sounds like a nightmare to some. And to me, that sounds awesome because it's my two favorite styles merged together. Also had their Orderville IPA over there. What else did I have? I stopped over at Ballast Point's tasting room over in Little Italy. Had another glass of the Victory at Sea Toasted Coconut. Have no regrets about that one. Still excellent. I really hope they bottle that because it's an excellent beer, an excellent take on an already very good beer. Also had their homework series batch. Cool program where they just kind of, you know, start testing some things out, and they have like it's for home brewers. They have a home brew mart too down in San Diego, so they have all the ingredients to come with it, and you can easily kind of, you know, use that as a baseline for what you want to make yourself. Also swung over to Bottlecraft, just a beer shop and tasting room right across the street from there. Had a Suburban Beverage. It was a Goza from Perennial Arts and Ales. It was very good. Had the Pupil, which I've had before, IPA from Society Brewing. Had Beechwood Brewing's Kilgore Stout. And yeah, that was pretty much it. I know that's not a small list, but that was everything.
Yeah, so hopefully many more in celebration on Friday and Sunday, because why wouldn't we drink on Easter?
That, I mean, Jesus probably did. So if I'm betting, I mean, if you came back from the dead, would you be drinking?
I mean, probably, yeah.
Shit, man. Like pop bottles. Like, I defied death. Get at me.
This is why cats are constantly hammered.
All right. So we alluded to a little bit before the break. You know, looking ahead, there's obviously one team we want to face, and there's obviously one team we don't want to face for matchup reasons. Dan, but you brought up a good point about UVA. Why would you want to face them, not for matchup reasons, but just for the sake of finally beating them?
Wait, did you say why would I want to be matched up with UVA? I think the one thing with UVA, which Iowa State wouldn't present, is UVA does not play all that well from behind. And luckily for them, they don't fall behind that often because their defense is really incredible. So, like, we've had a couple times in these UVA games where we've gone out to really hot starts, and then at the end of it, we're like, oh, we're up 12. I guess that's nice. But, like, there are other teams where we'd be up 20. And it allows them to claw back in. But if you actually do, like, sustain a really long period of awesome play and get up big on them, they don't have the type of the system of offense or the scoring punch to come back from a giant deficit. They're really efficient, but they don't really play fast. It's just not who they are.
Yeah, and you hit on, I think, the correct point there. It's the efficiency. I mean, you look back at the round of 32 game against Butler that they had last weekend, and most of that was caused by just, you know, lax defense on the part of Butler, some real gaffes, even on the offensive end, too. I just felt like Butler seemed to actively drag Virginia back to that game. I don't want to discredit Malcolm Brogdon and the way he played either. I think that he played incredibly well and really put that team on his back to get them first back into the game and then ahead of the Bulldogs for good. But Butler was their own undoing in many ways too. And yeah, I think that Butler's athletes might not be able to hang, which is what Virginia was doing. I think Syracuse might be able to hang a little bit better. Obviously, we lost to them earlier this year by double digits, but I think the fact that we know what's coming and we know what we need to do could be a little bit of an advantage, at least over, you know, a team like Gonzaga or a team like Iowa State, that we're really kind of seeing what they're up to for the first time.
Right. I think on the other hand, though, I had almost always rather face the team that doesn't see the zone all the time. And Virginia has had no issues with the zone. Even the first time they played it, like, it was same thing as, like, a lot of these Virginia games have been since we joined the ACC, and that was the Ennis team. Started off pretty hot, and then Virginia clawed its way back at half, and then they just ran us off the court in the second half. So I think even with Iowa State's offense, which is pretty dynamic, they have Niang, who I think could be a potential really dangerous zone-busting type player. I'd take my shot with Iowa State just being baffled by it, and Virginia, I'm pretty confident, would not be.
Yeah, I think that is the key there. It's a novelty. At the same time, though, to draw another parallel to the 2013 team, we faced Marquette in the Elite Eight that year.
I was there. This is true. And
Marquette had seen the zone.
They had, and they looked like they hadn't, because I think they scored like 39 points.
Yeah, that was, I mean, again, it was a defensive tour de force. It's something that, I think no matter what happens here or any other year, I think we'll always remember that team for just the absolute clinic it put on in terms of, I mean, you remember every single article. It was just in awe of, like, what is this zone? How is this so much better than it even was in the regular season when it had already been pretty good? And how is it shutting teams down? I don't think we're at that level this year, but, you know, and we talked about it in Slack. We talked about it a little bit in the article I put up yesterday, and for those listening, Tuesday, just about, you know, who we'd rather face these other three teams remaining. And Iowa State still, you know, ranks a heavy number one just based on the fact that they don't have a ton of size. They do rely heavily on hitting threes. And Jim Boeheim says himself all the time, like, if you're going to shoot threes on us all day, then, you know, we'll live and die on that. That's fine. And I'd have to agree at this point. I've been conditioned enough as a Syracuse fan to know that you occasionally lose those games, but much more often than not, you're going to come away with a win, because after a while, you know, even if a team starts hot, those shots rarely continue the whole time. Or even if they do, I mean, you look at Wisconsin several years back. I mean, those shots looked like they were going to fall the entire time we were playing against them. This is before, you know, that team really reached its apex. Their shots kept falling, but we just hit just enough, and the shots started clanking off at just the right time. I think to me that game, more than any other, is proof positive that if you're going to be a three-point shooting team, and that's the only way you know how to beat the zone, and I feel like that might be one of the only ways Iowa State has a real shot to beat the zone, you're probably going to lose if Syracuse can shoot with any sort of effectiveness.
Right, and it's basically the two ways. You could almost say three, but one of them is kind of an offset of the other. It's the play through the high post, and you kick out to shooters in the corners when the zone overcommits, or you play the high-low game like UNC did when they just ran that one set over and over and over and got those easy backdoor looks. And then there's the second, which is how most teams go, which is like, we're just in a fire, mad threes. And if you get red hot, you're going to probably beat Syracuse that way. But I think in terms, like, that's kind of like the lazy way to do it, where the more, like, focused, the Jamie Dixon approved method, shout out to the TCU Horned Frogs, who will never schedule now, as Sean said. And if they do, I'll freak out. But the Jamie Dixon approved method is the high low, the high post, you know, passing big men or passing big guard, you know, play smart basketball, be patient, etc. That has a much higher level of, you know, that's going to work more often, I'd say. But not every team has the roster to do it, and not every team has the patience to do it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good call. I think, you know, the Zags, for them, it's not the size that necessarily causes the advantage as much as what they can do at that size. I mean, if Sabonis shows that he has an ability to pass, and by all accounts, it seems like he has somewhat of an ability, even if not like an amazing one, if they can find ways to get Wilcher isolated on the perimeter and really play that kind of high-low a little bit more and do a lot of kickouts, or if a random guard gets hot, as we've seen many a time in Syracuse history, you know, that's when that game gets scary. I think it gets scary less when you have just two big guys that you're just going to run at us, because we've beaten those teams plenty. I mean, I wouldn't say we're favored against teams like that, but where North Carolina, with its bigger players, where they have an advantage over us is just athletes. I mean, yes, we have 4- and 5-star guys, but UNC has 5 stars largely across the board and guys who are, you know, future NBA lottery picks at nearly every position. I mean, that's where UNC beats us, is that, you know, they're not just going to run straight at us with these bigs. It's that they have so many other options, and you shut down one aspect of the game, there's another one that can meet it. But in the case of Gonzaga, and it's not to hate on Gonzaga at all, it's just to point out that, you know, offensively, the guards are not really going to be doing much of anything unless we have a surprise performance, which I, you know, hopefully we get to avoid.
Right, and they have some interesting players. McClellan is the guard I referenced before. He sits 4. He was Defensive Player of the Year in the WCC. And the guards actually have some decent size, but I think none of them is going to obviously be 6'7", and Darting Benajé, you know, he has the tendency to shoot over people. Malachi is kind of the same way at 6'6". And if the guards get going, I think it's going to be very good for Syracuse. And obviously for Zag on offense, like we said before, you can, you know, run your normal sets with your two bigs, and that's fine, but it's probably not going to be that effective. It's, you know, can Sabonis go to the free throw line and make accurate passes and kind of be a playmaker from there, which I haven't watched enough of him. I know he's very good. He's a really nice, you know, he'll store on the block and grab a ton of boards, but that might be a little outside of how they usually use him. And then Wilcher, obviously, is a very, very good shooter. Shoots 43% from 3, which is terrifying. The question is, you know, how do they get him open looks? And sometimes, you know, it seems like it should be easy against his own, and then sometimes the wings play up really tight, and it's incredibly difficult unless you have someone from the middle creating. So I think if Gonzaga really game plans well and looks at what works for teams like Pitt, who don't even have the same type of forwards. Like, they have ones who beat the zone really well, but I think it's just because it's like being into them. But if they looked at those kind of things and they just totally dedicate themselves to that strategy, I think there's a very good chance they'll beat Syracuse. I think those two players are you know, it split a lot of the weaknesses of the Syracuse roster. But if not, if they're just going to go gun and play straight up, I like Syracuse's chances almost every time.
Yeah, you know, I always wonder why people don't emulate Pitt more. I mean, it's not as if this is like a small sample size anymore. Yes, we won a couple games in a row for a small portion of time, but obviously since Jamie Dixon took over and now that he's done, they're 15-6 against Syracuse, should be 16-5 if not for a miracle shot from Tyler Ennis. To me, I just think they seem like an easy team to not an easy team to copy, but an easy team for, you know, teams to kind of try to glean something from. I know I kind of touched on it in that piece a few weeks back, talking about, you know, the kind of time loop that we're in with Pitt, and now we don't ever have to be in again. And, you know, maybe to another extent, you know, Virginia, I mean, Virginia's elevated the level of athlete in the door. Pitt has two, but, you know, you're not seeing just like a slew of five-star guys there. So it's not necessarily a talent advantage. It's just the style of play advantage that plenty of teams around the country, you know, can mimic. It's just weird that very few have tried to.
Yeah, it is strange because it's not a secret. Like every one of those, you know, there's like a zone breakdown feature with whoever the analyst is, like pretty much every time Syracuse plays at this point. So it's not like it's a, you know, it's something that teams don't understand. I mean, it's covered pretty extensively. So maybe it's harder to train an offense to run that type of system on a dime, or harder than we understand, but it really does seem like a no-brainer. And I'd say like 80% of teams that we play just don't even try.
Yeah, which weird. But whatever, don't start now. Especially you.
No, please don't. It's not a good strategy. Oh, don't ever do it.
It's terrible. I mean, look at Pitt. They lost in the first round. It can't work that well.
No, they didn't even beat Syracuse in the first round.
Shh.
Syracuse won and Pitt lost.
So I guess in our closing moments, still got like 7 or 8 minutes, but want to just do a quick kind of round robin of the other matchups in the Sweet 16, because obviously, you know, we could face literally any of these squads if we win. So, I mean, if not next round, potentially down the road, if we start doing, you know, ridiculous circus type things with my sanity and mind and everything else. Dan, just going down the list, Virginia, Iowa State. Who do you got and why?
We wrote off Iowa State before the tournament. Yes. Obviously, they've gotten this far. I still haven't gotten like stuff back in because they're so much fun to watch. I at this point, I kind of expected myself to be back in on them, and I'm just not. They're really talented, but I just trust Virginia a lot more. I think Virginia, we talked about it back before Michigan State got embarrassed by Middle Tennessee. Like, that was the team that was kind of their poison, but they had kind of branded a little bit of a tournament. Like, you know, they struggled in the tournament under Bennett, which is just totally unfair. It's just they lost to Michigan State 2 years in a row as a high seed.
And it was going
to
be three.
And it was going to be three. We laughed pretty hard about it when the seeding came out, especially because I think I tweeted it as soon as Michigan State didn't show up as a one seed. I'm like, yep, Virginia's going to get them. And they did. And, of course, history happened. So congrats, Virginia. I just trust the Cavs more. I think they're destined to make a run at some point on the Brogdon era. He's just an unbelievable player that really goes underappreciated. And that whole team is really nice. We've actually also had a lot of like Virginia love on the site today, mostly because of the open letter. A lot of Virginia fans showed up out of nowhere. So I guess I'm kind of rooting for them. They're not the prettiest team to watch, but I appreciate what they do. Just as they, like any team that just executes their style of play to such perfection for three straight years now kind of deserves some kind of pat on the back. So I just trust Virginia more. I think at this point they should be able to get to the Elite Eight. They've earned it as a program. So I like the Hoos.
That's fair. I mean, they've gotten more watchable over time, I'll admit. I think they're much more watchable now than they might have been last year or the year before.
Yeah, they've actually scored a lot in this tournament. I think it's more because like the defenses they played haven't been great, but they've put on some points in the tournament, which has been nice.
Oh, of course, and honestly, like if you haven't really sat down with Malcolm Brogdon's game or haven't like watched a ton of him, go watch. This is not to you, Dan. I know. go watch the portion of the Butler game, probably from about 8 or 9 minutes to go until about the 3 minute mark, where Brogdon takes over the game, absolutely positively takes over the game, just barrels into the lane, but in a very controlled way, and just slices right through that Butler defense in half a second. It's a feat to watch, and the fact that he just kept doing it was I think the most maddening thing, especially for someone like me that wouldn't have minded seeing some more brackets bust, especially on the other side of ours. It was insane to watch, but it was also a reminder of just how good Brogdon is and just how much his career has been disserviced by a couple, you know, chance meetings with Michigan State for the Hoos.
Right, and there's a reason why he's one of the four Naismith finalists. Like, that wasn't a gift. Like, he was very much worthy, and I don't think he's going to beat out Buddy Hield, and, you know, Buddy Hield's amazing, and if you root against Buddy Hield, you don't have a soul.
You went to Texas.
Or you went to Texas, and, you know, do you have a soul then, either? I don't know.
It's debatable.
I think you sold it for the Longhorn Network, and that was a bad trade. I think Brogdon's awesome. And he's, you know, quiet star player, and I will have no problem putting on my, like, ACC pride hat if Syracuse does bow out before we play Virginia. So, go Hoos for now, for one more round.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'd like to pick Iowa State, if only because I'm projecting to, if Syracuse wins, who I'd rather face. But if we're playing by the media's rules, you know, Iowa State beat a 13 and a 12 to get here. So they're obviously a shit team. Obviously. If we're gonna
For
play,
sure.
Yeah, if we're going to play by those rules, like you're bad. You mean you're terrible. So playing by the media's rules, we're obviously picking Virginia. I think in general I'm just picking Virginia. I think that, you know, the Michigan State thing, I think it actually become like a mental tick. And if it came down to it, they might have imploded, either knowing that Michigan State was there or actually seeing Michigan State across the court from them. the fact that Michigan State's not there is enough to power them through. Again, rooting against it for now, not because I hate you guys, Hoos, actually like you guys a lot, but rooting against it, if only for our own self-interest. If the game times were switched, I might have a different answer.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think I will try not to do it myself, but if Iowa State pulls the upset, like, we're going to hear, like, oh, what if we can do it?
Yep. And everyone...
This is exactly what happened when we went Michigan State, when Michigan State lost, and then also exactly what happened...
when we won last week.
Yeah.
This but is what happens.
It was perfect. Us. Like, yeah. it was perfect Syracuse.
So SU. All right, going a little bit quicker on the other matchups. I know a lot of ACC stuff in here, so it's kind of hard to stay on track when we actually know and like a lot of these teams. Continuing up instead, Notre Dame, Wisconsin. I know Wisconsin got very lucky. I'm still going with the Badgers. I think that their poor shooting against Xavier was maybe more of a product of the Musketeers' defense. I haven't been enthralled with Notre Dame's defense consistently enough to buy into them. I also, Notre Dame won on its own Hail Mary, basically, last week. So I'm going with Wisconsin. I'm also going with my own bracket where I picked Wisconsin to get to the Elite Eight.
I did the same thing. I picked Wisconsin at the Elite Eight. I had them beating West Virginia, not Notre Dame, but that's fine. And you statistically are very good at identifying bad defenses, because Notre Dame's is the worst left in the field with a bullet. Duke, according to KenPom, is at 109 in the country, and they're 19th overall in KenPom, but 109 in defense. Notre Dame is at 172 in defense, and KenPom overall has them as the worst team left in the field. So shout out to KenPom. Syracuse is only third worst, ahead of Wisconsin and Notre Dame. So I will also take the Badgers. I think they are a little more well-rounded. I think there's – at some point, Nigel Hayes has to learn how to play basketball again. He's had an awful tournament, and they keep on winning, and he's their best player. So I think he will reemerge at some point here. Hap has been kind of a revelation for them in this whole, like, resurgence that Wisconsin's had. Bronson Tanage, obviously, is nasty and is just a big shot maker.
I mean, do you see that shot chart? that Vice Sports put out today?
Yes.
Like
a different team. Like halfway through the year, they flipped the switch. Like, all right, we're gonna be good again.
And really good.
Yeah, holy shit. Yeah. And the cannon shot was unbelievable. I just trust what's again. This is like a probably a totally unfair field thing. I trust Wisconsin more. I know Notre Dame made a nice run last year, but that team had some, Jarian Grant was on that team. That team was a little more well-rounded, I think. And Notre Dame just doesn't play defense. Like, they haven't played defense all year. We've seen what happens when it gets the worst of them up close to Syracuse. Absolutely dominated them this year in a game where they played no defense. So I'm going to take the Badgers. I think Notre Dame could, come out on fire and just blow them out. But
yeah, I think they're going to get lit up in the Elite Eight if they do that.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I like the Badgers here.
Fair enough. All right. So, what's more cream? The game that we play every week.
America's favorite
game show.
Favorite game show.
Cream, stars, and celebrities. Do they know something? But, all right. Looking at this.
Was that a BoJack Horseman reference?
It was a BoJack Horseman reference.
Fantastic.
So North Carolina and Indiana. What's more cream? Indiana getting destroyed by North Carolina in this game, or Indiana winning by 15 and then losing to Wisconsin?
Ooh. I don't know. That's tough. I think I'm gonna go with Indiana beating North Carolina because this is the something anniversary of basically, I think it was in this played in the same place as Indiana beating North Carolina in 84 in the Michael Jordan's last year, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Dockage, of all people, shut him down on defense, which doesn't make any sense. No. So I'm sure Indiana's a scrappy white guy who can box out Bryce Johnson all game. Probably not, but we'll see. So I think Indiana beating UNC and then losing by 20 to Wisconsin would be more green. But I don't think they will. I like Indiana. We've talked about this, begrudgingly. Indiana's really talented. They beat Kentucky, which is no small feat. A lot of really good athletes. This isn't even I don't even think it'd be that crazy to pick Indiana. I'm going to go with UNC. They're playing really well. I think their size will still give Indiana problems. Even if Indiana, Yogi Ferrell has some senior year magic stuff going on right now. But I think this one actually should be a lot of fun. All joking aside, I don't think we'll get a creaming. I think UNC will beat a very talented UNC team will beat Indiana, but it should be actually a pretty good game.
No, I concur. I think this is the marquee game of the Sweet 16 matchups, and that's fine. It's Blue Bloods. There's always a lot on the line there. There's always a lot of fun at stake, and I'll take it. Quick take without any reasoning at all: North Carolina or Wisconsin? Dan, I'm picking North Carolina.
Yeah, I just think North Carolina's better. I had Kentucky winning this region. Obviously, that's gone. So I think UNC is just really talented. I think they do always run the risk of going super cold and just not hitting any jump shots. But I think if any team can survive that, it's them just because they have Bryce, they have Kennedy Meeks, they have Isaiah Hicks. They have a lot of options down low, and no other team has that number of them. So I just think they're very talented. None of these teams would really surprise me. Maybe Notre Dame a little bit just because their defense is so I think either one of the Indiana Notre Dame or Indiana North Carolina teams will probably win that region.
Fair enough. Moving over to the other side, Kansas and Maryland. I don't buy Maryland at all. They wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for the Cal injury before the first round game. I'm going with Kansas because, despite my belief in North Carolina, they are the team I picked to win after all. I still think Kansas might have the best top-to-bottom talent in the entire tournament, and I'm very much buying the Jayhawks to wipe the floor with Maryland.
Yeah, Maryland just, I think if Maryland had really showed something the last couple games, maybe this would be closer, maybe we could buy into Maryland kind of bouncing back on the right time. But they looked very against South Dakota State. They didn't look great against Hawaii. They won both those games. It wasn't super close down the stretch. But Kansas is just rolling. They look really good. They probably do have the most talent, especially in a game that's dominated by the backcourt. UNC has the most frontcourt talent, but Kansas has three guards that are just really hard to deal with. Especially Devontae Graham is coming along in a big way. So I really like them to win this one pretty comfortably. And I think at this point they're the runaway favorite in the tournament. Obviously anything could happen from here, but it's really hard to believe that Kansas won't have at least a really good shot at winning this whole thing.
I would agree. And moving to the other side of their bracket, Miami and Villanova. Villanova, if you had faced Temple, I don't know if you would have made it out, but you destroyed Iowa in a way that I wasn't sure anyone could. That's less a commentary on Iowa being good, more a commentary on just Villanova being able to just utterly dominate that team in a way you rarely see in the tournament, in a second-round game. I think Nova has what it takes to beat Miami. I just think Miami can get streaky from the field. They got a little cold for a bit against Wichita State, and you saw things get a little shaky. The one plus for Miami, though, is the veteran leadership they have there, and the fact that these guys have been through the paces. They understand what they need to do, and they play decent enough defense. I like Villanova, and by like, I mean I think they're going to win. I hate Villanova in principle. But yeah, it sets up what should be a very entertaining, in my bracket at least, Kansas-Villanova Elite Eight.
Yeah, I don't love picking Villanova here just because I'm still kind of starred by the last couple of years of watching Villanova play in the tournament. But man, they're playing like awesome ball so far in this thing. Miami's played pretty well too. The holding off Wichita State was really impressive considering what that comeback looked like for a minute.
No small feat, especially given the tournament experience on that team.
No, and Wichita's just really good. And they made a big run in Miami after Miami came out, like, you know, their heads were on fire. This is probably the toughest game of this whole round, I think. I think Miami has a nice size advantage. Jatiri's obviously really awesome. Angel Rodriguez in the backcourt's playing really great after, you know, he can be streaky sometimes. I think Nova, you could argue they've been playing the best basketball of this whole tournament. I'm just deciding this now. I'm going to take Miami. I just feel like they'll rip this one out. And this is no knock on Villanova. They could easily win this one. I just like how Miami's backcourt's playing. I think they'll have the advantage in the front court. And Larrañaga, I think, is an awesome coach. But this one, like, I think this is a legit coin flip. So I could go either way. By Thursday, I might totally change my mind.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. I picked Miami in my bracket. I picked Villanova here. I would obviously prefer Miami in general. But into the next matchup, whether it's Kansas against Villanova or Kansas-Miami, quick take. I'm taking Kansas for all the aforementioned reasons of talent, just pure domination, and the fact that this team seems like they're on a collision course with somebody good in the Final Four.
Yeah, I would love it for it to be a 2003 rematch between Kansas and the, doesn't deserve to be in the national championship game, Syracuse Orange.
I would like anyone but Kansas to be on the other side of that if Syracuse were to get there.
Well, obviously, yeah, I would love to play pretty much anyone else. But I think getting in the national championship would be absurd, and
yeah,
the
03
rematch would
there.
Be crazy. Let's go. Syracuse, Maryland. That'd be great.
The replacement cup.
The conference realignment. Sponsored by the dude from West Virginia. No, I totally agree on Kansas, though. They have to be the favorite to win the whole thing from here on out. So I will take them pretty comfortably over either one of Miami or Villanova.
Buy it. And then the last two games, Oregon and Duke. St. Joe's really pushed Oregon, and I really thought that, you know, Oregon was gonna lose that game. But St. Joe's kind of unraveled themselves. Oregon obviously had some timely shooting toward the end, but I just don't know if Duke can keep up for the full 40. I mean, maybe the week off re-energizes them and gets them through to the Elite Eight. I mean, it's quite possible. Obviously, Duke is very talented just from a 1-5 standpoint. And again, you and I said it, you know, weeks ago when we started previewing the tournament. It was just, you know, can they stay healthy enough and can they stay fresh enough? I think they might be able to against Oregon. I'm going to go with the Blue Devils. And then on the other side, I'm going to go with Oklahoma because, you know, Buddy Hield is Buddy Hield. And you saw what Oklahoma was able to do against VCU early in the game last week before Hield really even caught fire. And then obviously what he did in the second half. A&M needed a miracle, literally, to get through to this round. After playing so well against Green Bay, I'm very surprised at how poor they looked against Northern Iowa. I think A&M's trip has run out, so I'm going Duke and Oklahoma in the Elite Eight, with Oklahoma just simply outlasting them in a very kind of fast-paced war of attrition come Sunday. Or is it Saturday? I forgot what day they're playing.
I think it would be Saturday. So I'm going to take Oregon. I think Duke's lack of depth might come to roost here. Coach Tay actually talked about it today. He said Oregon. He almost said a quote that almost reminds me of the 2010 Syracuse team. They basically have seven starters, and they do. They have eight guys that play over – or actually, no, it's seven. Seven guys who play over 20 minutes. Very balanced across the board. I don't think Dylan Brooks is a Wes Johnson, but he's a very good player. Super impressive down the stretch at St. Joe's. So I think it'll be a really close one. I think Duke has the better top-end talent, but I think Oregon might be able to just throw too many bodies and rotate, you know, too much for Duke to really keep up. And I'm not buying this Duke team. I think Grayson Allen's awesome. I think Plumlee's come along really impressively. Ingram's great. But I don't know. A team with that little depth, it really makes it hard for me to believe in them really deep in March. So I think I'll take Oregon in a close one. And then, like you, I just think Buddy Hield's playing too good right now. He looked like a man possessed in the second half of that last round game. Texas A&M I like, but, I mean, the comeback at the end of Northern Iowa, like, I watched it, and I don't think I really processed how ridiculous it was until I, like, went and watched, just watched, like, a replay of it, because I was just, like, kind of, like, they just keep on scoring. It just was so crazy. But I just think Buddy Hield is proving why he's been, you know, he was basically player of the year, favorite from wire to wire, except for like a little bit of a Denzel Valentine interjection towards the end of the regular season. Obviously, I think Valentine probably isn't going to win that now, assuming, I don't know if you'd know, voting I think is not up, right? Voting's still going?
Yeah, because, well, diving into my work, AT&T used to sponsor the Naismith Trophy, so I usually knew how the voting was going. Now I don't. I'm pretty sure that wraps up.
I think it's before the Final Four.
It's before the Final Four, but yeah, I think it's before the Final Four. And like, I think it wraps up maybe that Friday around midnight. I know Oscar Robertson votes were already due because I put mine in. So I think Oscar Robertson votes were wrapped up before the tournament started.
Okay, so when Trevor Tooney gets a vote, you all know who it was.
Definitely not voting for Trevor Tooney.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hield has the Naismith and probably the Robertson locked up, especially because Valentine's out and Ulis is out, unless Brogdon decides to score 70 this weekend. But he's awesome. He's fun to watch. He seems like a great like player to root for. His interviews are amazing. So, and you know, there just isn't a better pure scorer in college basketball. So I think they'll outdo A&M. And then, I had Oklahoma winning that region from the start. And it's one of the few things I can still, pencil in here as we go forward. Cause the left side of my bracket's in decent shape. The right side is a tire fire. So
knock on wood, I can still hang my hat on 3 out of 4.
Yeah, no.
Well, that's cause you pick Michigan State.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a smart person. Me and 41% of the world, I think.
That's almost the exact reason why I did not pick Michigan State.
Yeah, see, I always tell myself I'm going to pick like strategically like that, and then at the end I'm like, I just like this bracket, and this is what I'm going to do, and then I do that. So maybe next year I'll actually like strategically fill out.
That's fair. I think from when I was younger and I was rooting for Syracuse and North Carolina, I think my old heels homerism shows up sometimes when I fill out these brackets. Because anytime UNC is a one seed, I usually just pick them to win the whole thing. It's probably bad.
Yeah, especially with, you know, I don't want to, like, do the whole, like, Roy Williams is a bad coach thing, but except from, like, 09. 09, I picked them, and I just ran away with it. I think I won my whole bracket that year, and that wasn't exactly, like, the hardest pick of the world, but I felt pretty good about that one.
Yeah. I feel pretty good about this one, but obviously there's plenty more to happen. I think they're in a tough bracket. So, yeah, we'll see. I think that People have probably listened to us enough, Dan, since we're nearing the hour and 15 mark.
Oh, that's too much of us.
That's way too much of us. All right, so that was Dan. I'm John. Dan, thanks as always for joining.
Yes, we will. I look forward to our Final Four preview next week.
Yes, hopefully we join you all next week celebrating a Final Four berth. And if not, I think we'll still manage to be fairly positive and optimistic unless some really stupid officiating error happens at the end of this game. Please no.
Yes, no.
Please no. All right. So again, that was Dan. I'm John. You've been listening to Tri-Noons, an absolute podcast. We will see you next week. Go Orange.
Go Orange.